months of slow progress, the U.S. campaign to vaccinate us against COVID-19 is gaining real speed. Healthcare workers are now giving out as many as 4 million shots a day around the country. And this week, President Biden moved up the deadline for all adults to be eligible from May 1st to April 19th. This is all good news. So when do we get our lives back? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Most Americans have grown accustomed to masking up when we leave home, but even those of us who do so willingly, in the interest of public health, are eager for the day when we can stop being so careful, when public transit, cross-country travel, indoor restaurant meals, and crowded places don't seem like risky choices. So we've invited an expert to help us figure out how close we are to the day when all the things we love are once again deemed generally safe. Dr. Celine Gounder is an internist, infectious disease specialist, and epidemiologist at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. She served as COVID advisor to the Biden transition team, and she is host of the podcasts Epidemic and American Diagnosis. Dr. Gounder, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
Give us a ballpark sense of how you're feeling right now about the progress we've made on vaccinating a percentage of the population and reducing transmission. Is this where you expected us to be by early to mid-April 2021?
Honestly, no. I think we've really accomplished a tremendous amount in the first couple months of 2021. I think many of us were concerned, frankly, you know, including some of my colleagues on the advisory board, that we would not be able to hit a million doses in arms per day, that seemed like an overly ambitious goal, given some of the concerns we had about vaccine supply at that time. And so I think we've really outperformed tremendously, and there's a lot to feel really good about there.
You advised the Biden transition team about COVID-19. Tell us a little about what that role entailed and what the Biden folks needed from you.
Oh, gosh. So, you know, as a team, as a group of 16 of us who are members of this advisory board, we spent a huge amount of time partly talking amongst ourselves, but mostly with other stakeholders, everybody from teachers unions to labs, the big lab companies, to the pharmaceutical companies, to, you know, the National Urban League, for example, you know, really trying to reach all of the different people who have a role to play, who have been affected. And so it was probably 6 to 8 hours of calls a day with all of these different groups. You know, we would sort of split up the work, a couple of us on each call, and then we would reconvene once or a couple times a week to discuss specific issues. You know, one I can tell you as an example, on Christmas Eve, we all came together to talk about this UK variant, the B117, which is now the dominant strain here in the United States. And so we got together Christmas Eve, virtually, of course, to discuss, you know, what did this mean that this had been detected, and what was it going to mean for us? So, you know, some of it was big picture planning. Some of it was reacting to what was happening in the moment.
What sort of cooperation did you and your team and folks currently in the Biden administration have from their counterparts in the Trump administration?
Well, you know, it was a bit challenging in terms of getting a full transparency into the situation on the ground. But I think at the same time, you have a lot of career, and I'm using this word in the nicest way possible, bureaucrats. So people who really are about this, about public service. That, you know, they've spent their entire careers under both Republican and Democratic administrations doing this work. They're really scientific professionals, health professionals. And so those people, you know, are pretty good to work with because we're all really on the same team wanting to serve the American people.
What kinds of refinements have been made to mass vaccination efforts over time based on trial and error in the early days? Like, how is the system working more smoothly now than it was a few months ago, and why?
Well, I think there have been some improvements in some of the scheduling processes. You know, I think we were overly dependent, especially in the beginning, on the websites. And, you know, there's still work to be done on that front. Both in terms of opening up alternatives and in making those easier to navigate. But, you know, part of what's happening now is a shift to having more available through just, you know, old-fashioned call centers, but also really importantly doing more outreach to get people registered and scheduled for appointments, creating walk-in sites that make it a lot easier for people just to show up and get vaccinated. And then, you know, pop-up and mobile clinics that also are really expanding access.
Yeah, how much progress has been made getting doses to underserved, low-income, and rural populations?
Well, again, there's work to be done still. I think with communities of color, there's been tremendous work that's been done really by people within the community. So, you know, doctors of color who have really organized educational events, outreach, spending a lot of time explaining, you know, how are these vaccines developed? How do we know they're safe and effective? How do we know they're safe and effective in people like us? Which is a question, you know, I often get is, how do I know that this is going to work for me or be safe for me? And so I think a lot of that outreach has been very effective because we are seeing the intent to get vaccinated increase in communities of color. I do think we still have work to do in rural communities that just hadn't been our emphasis. But I think some of the same strategies could well work. It really comes down to listening to people, hearing their concerns. They need to feel like you care about them in a really genuine human way. And only then can you start to try to get any message across.
Given where we are now, do you have a date in your head when you imagine every American who wants a vaccine will have received all the necessary doses?
I think we're looking at sometime midsummer, probably July or so would be my best guess as to, you know, every American who wants to be vaccinated will have been able to be vaccinated at that point. So, you know, we just have a little bit longer to go, but we're almost there.
What sort of data will scientists use to begin to estimate the functional lifespan of COVID vaccination? Do we have to wait for the protection to stop working for some people in order to know when we'll need additional or amended doses of vaccine, if that is necessary?
Well, I think the reason we're likely to have booster doses is not because of waning immunity per se. It's rather that we are seeing these new variants. For example, the variant that was detected in South Africa, the B1351 variant, that our immune systems, our immune responses to natural infection, as well as to some degree to the vaccines, is not as protective as those immune responses are to the original strains of the virus. And so that's challenging because we don't quite know how long our immune systems after vaccination will remain able to fight off some of these variant strains as well. But it's likely that if we get boosters, it's not because our immune systems have gotten weaker or have forgotten, you know, lost that immune memory, but rather because the virus is getting ahead of us.
So the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that are in use in the U.S. are some of the first mRNA vaccines that have been released for use to the general public. They sound really brand new to a lot of us, but they've been, in a certain way, in development for 50 years, right?
Yeah, that's right. These have been in development for decades, and we've been studying them, looking at them, developing them for other viruses. So, for example, for SARS, for MERS. And so it was actually pretty easy to modify them, update them for SARS-CoV-2. We've also been looking at this type of vaccine in the context of cancer, which is another, you know, an interesting strategy to address cancer. So these are not brand new technologies by any means. And I think we were very lucky that these technologies had been under study, had been in development already for so long, because that really gave us a head start.
So it speaks to the value of science for its own sake, even when there's not necessarily an immediate or even a medium-term payoff visible.
Right. And I think part of the reason vaccines were being developed for SARS and MERS was not necessarily that we thought there was going to be a big outbreak of SARS or MERS, but rather the understanding that those were coronaviruses that did have potential to cause epidemics or possibly even a pandemic, that other coronaviruses might as well. and that it was important to start developing the science of coronavirus vaccines. Those were the ones we had available to work with at the time. And so there was a recognition that really needed to be studied, and we're very fortunate people did.
I know that some common colds are caused by coronaviruses, not the one that causes COVID-19. We've never had a vaccine for this, and of course, it's usually not a dangerous illness, but it costs billions of dollars a year in lost productivity and doctor visits and medicine. Any chance that the work that's being done on these vaccines that could stop this deadly pandemic might someday translate into something that could relieve us of the inconvenience of something like colds?
I mean, it's certainly possible. That said, the family of coronaviruses that cause the common cold are slightly different from the family that cause MERS, SARS, and SARS-CoV-2. And there are a number of other viruses that also cause the common cold, like adenoviruses and rhinoviruses. And so I don't think we'll ever, unfortunately, be free of common colds because there are just too many viruses that cause them.
You mentioned cancer. How can a vaccine potentially be used against cancer?
So what you're trying to do is teach your immune system to recognize the cancer and to fight off the cancer. And a number of new therapies, it's a class of therapies called immunotherapies, really try to harness the immune system to do the work of what chemotherapy might do. And the idea is to be much more targeted, where your immune system can be trained to recognize the cancer and fight that off without fighting off normal cells in the body. So you're not getting the side effects that you might, for example, with chemotherapy.
So this kind of therapy, I don't want to get too far afield here, but I know lots of people have an interest in this. This kind of therapy could be targeted to like your precise specific cancer as opposed to all people that have this general class of cancers.
Yeah, that would be one. Or you could be targeting what is known to be a marker of a particular type of cancer, maybe a particular type of breast cancer or colon cancer. So theoretically, you know, you could target a vaccine that would teach your immune system to do that. You know, we're not there yet, but this is very promising. And there are immunotherapies that are not the vaccine themselves, but that essentially are the antibodies that your immune system might produce if given such a vaccine. And those antibodies can be infused and targeted against your cancer. And that is a therapy that we're using against cancers like melanoma, for example.
All right, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines need follow-up shots 3 or 4 weeks later. How much protection do people have after that first dose?
The data that we've seen is that after the first dose, so 14 days after that first dose, because it takes about 14 days for your immune system to see the vaccine, to learn what, you know, what that is, and then to develop a response. So it takes about 14 days after that first dose. At that point, we see an 80% reduction in infections. And then after two doses, 14 days after two doses, you see a 90% reduction in infections. So that's quite significant. I mean, this is about as good as it gets with a vaccine.
So Dr. Gounder, if the vaccine is 80% effective after that single first dose 2 weeks later, why do we need the second one? If the Johnson & Johnson vaccine effectiveness is something like in the 60s to 70s in terms of effectiveness?
That's a great question. I think you also have to look at how long you have protection. And if you look at data, for example, out of Scotland, where they have looked at how long does that immune response last, you know, they have this longer period between doses. They're waiting 12 weeks between doses in the UK, which includes Scotland. And we've seen that around week 5 or so after the Pfizer vaccine, you do start to see a drop in neutralizing antibody levels. You start to see more hospitalizations again. And so that's concerning because you really want to prime and boost the immune system so that you have a robust immune response and also a durable, long-lasting immune response. So you really do need that second dose.
How long after the full vaccination course, whether that's one dose with the Johnson & Johnson or two doses for Pfizer and Moderna, how long after that can we start to resume normal activity? And do you put an asterisk next to what normal activity is now?
Yeah, I would. So I think if you have been vaccinated and you are, you know, pursuing normal activities with other people who have also been fully vaccinated, and by fully vaccinated, I mean 2 weeks, 14 days after you've received either both doses of Pfizer and Moderna or one dose of Johnson & Johnson, you have to wait that 2 weeks. But if you're doing something with a group of people who've all been vaccinated, you really can behave like you would normally. You could do it without masks. You could do that indoors. I think where it becomes stickier is when you're out in public. You know, really at that point, we would advise still wearing a mask. You really do still want to be avoiding crowds, even if you've been vaccinated, especially crowds indoors. And if you're around other people who have not yet been fortunate enough to be vaccinated, there are some caveats here as well. We would say that if those people who have not been vaccinated are high risk for severe COVID, that you really do continue with the mitigation measures as well, because we really don't want those folks exposed. Your risk is certainly lower, but it's not zero, especially as long as there's a lot of transmission in the community. And so you could inadvertently be a carrier and infect somebody. And we certainly wouldn't want that to happen if that person is high risk for severe disease.
When will we have definitive information on whether vaccinated people who are protected from infection themselves might still transmit the virus to unvaccinated people?
So there's a large study called the Prevent COVID U study, which is being conducted across some 20 or so colleges and universities across the country. They're going to be enrolling 12,000 students in this study. Half will get the Moderna vaccine at the very beginning. Half will get the Moderna vaccine 4 months later, so towards the end of the study. And what they're going to look at is not just you yourself, but the people around you. What is the risk to the people around you of getting COVID? Because if the vaccine is reducing transmission, it means that it's not just protecting you, but it's protecting others indirectly. And so this gets at that concept of herd immunity, where if enough people are immune, the virus has no place to go. And so that study is just getting off the ground. As I said, it'll take about 4 months to complete that study, and then we'll have to wait for the analysis of the results. But I'm hopeful that by later this year, we'll have a more direct answer on the question of preventing transmission.
Why are vaccines still recommended for people who caught but recovered from COVID-19?
So we have seen that the natural infection, your immune response to the natural infection is more variable, which means in some people it's strong, in some people it's not that strong what's left over, and it doesn't last that long. And we're not going to test every single American who's had COVID to figure out how strong their remaining immune response is. It's just not feasible to do that. And secondly, with the rise of these different variants, like the one I mentioned out of South Africa, the B1351 variant, that variant is resistant to your immune response to the original strains of coronavirus. And those are spreading, those other variants are spreading. We have some of our own homegrown versions of that as well that we just are still learning more about. And so you really want the strongest, longest lasting protection against all of the different strains that are out there.
What makes those new variants more transmissible than the COVID original version?
Yeah, so the UK variant, the B117 variant, there's a couple different ways it appears to do that. One, you know, we've all heard about the spike protein, which studs the surface of the virus. It's those little projections that you see in the pictures. That attaches to a molecule called the ACE2 receptor. So it's the way I think about it, it's like the spike protein is the key that unlocks the door into your cells. And what's happened is that key has gotten a lot better. And so the coronavirus is able to attach to cells in the human body and penetrate those cells, infect those cells much more effectively. So that's part of it, sort of at the microscopic level. What we're also seeing is people who have that variant have higher levels of virus, and they have the virus for longer. And so much of transmission is really a game of chance, of probabilities. And so you increase the probability of transmitting from one person to another when there's just more virus and it's around for longer.
There's been significant debate around the question of whether something like a vaccine passport can be required of people who want to travel to certain places or take part in activities. What do you see as the pros and cons of making participation contingent on vaccination when the U.S. is not likely to pass a law requiring Americans to be vaccinated?
Well, I don't love the term passports, in part because that implies your identity is linked to this, and there's this tracking system of people and you know, their health status, because that's not really how these things work. Secondly, if you look at some of what's in development, I think it's more accurate to call these COVID health credentials or health status credentials, because they're building in not just vaccination information, but also testing. So let's say you're somebody who just, for whatever reason, can't or won't get vaccinated. These apps or these paper systems will also be tracking, did you get a test? You know, we're already, for example, in big sports venues and other theaters and the like, people can also present a negative test within the last day or two to demonstrate that they're not an infectious risk to others. So I think as long as you have a system that allows different options, maybe you show you've been vaccinated, or maybe you show I've had a negative test in the last day or two, that essentially clears you and shows you not to be an infectious threat to others, and so can safely enter that space.
We often hear about this sort of race to get people vaccinated because of the spread of the variants of the virus. Can you explain why it's particularly important now that the time and speed are of the essence with the variants that are spreading throughout the population?
Yeah, so the variant that we're currently most worried about in the U.S. is the B.1.1.7 variant out of that was first detected in the U.K. So this variant is more infectious. It spreads more easily from one person to another. So if I am infected, I will end up infecting more people around me than if I had the original strain. Secondly, it is more virulent, which means that it causes more severe disease. And we're seeing in places like Michigan that really saw this earliest in this wave, Michigan and then parts of the Northeast, for example, we're seeing young people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who are being hospitalized with COVID at much higher rates with the B.1.1.7 variant than we did with the original strain. So I think a lot of younger people think, oh, well, I'm not gonna get a bad case, it's not a big deal. That is not true with this variant. And I think it's been a little bit tricky to tease out the impact of the old virus, the old original strain of coronavirus, and now this incoming new strain variant B.1.1.7. And in a sense, you have overlapping epidemics. One is fading, one is coming in. But it's really important because this one spreads so much more easily. It's what's led to the UK having to implement strict lockdowns, and now many parts of Europe, France, the ICUs in Paris have been overrun because of this particular variant, and they're having to implement strict lockdown measures. And we just don't want to have to do that if we don't, if we can vaccinate to prevent transmission instead of having to re-implement strict measures, we really would rather go that route. So we have to vaccinate as quickly as we can right now.
And how well do the existing vaccines protect against B.1.1.7?
Well, the good news is if you are fully vaccinated, they provide excellent protection against B.1.1.7. The bad news is if you only have one dose of Pfizer or Moderna, you do not have good protection. And so this is all the more reason it's really important to get your first and second doses, get both of them and get both of them on time, because we are in the middle of the spread of the B.1.1.7.
I've read reports that by late summer, the U.S. might actually have a glut of vaccine doses on hand, more left over than people who want or need them. How might the United States make decisions about sharing those doses with other countries that do need them?
Well, a month or so ago now, it was reported that Johnson & Johnson and Merck were in agreement for Merck to help Johnson & Johnson scale up its production of vaccine. And by the way, that's unheard of. That's amazing in terms of that kind of support in the private sector, one company helping the other in that way. But that also speaks to what a unique time this is. But the whole idea of being able to ramp up supply of the Johnson and Johnson vaccine, which is a one-dose vaccine, does not have the same cold storage requirements that you have with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. The whole idea here was really to help produce vaccine for the rest of the world. And so the two key vaccines in terms of the world are the Johnson and Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine. The AstraZeneca vaccine is being produced locally in many countries. India, for example, they have a big, what's called the Serum Institute, which is one of the world's largest manufacturers of vaccines. They're producing AstraZeneca. There are a number of places in Europe, many countries outside of Europe as well, like Brazil has been given the information on, the intellectual property for how do you do this, and they're gearing up to make their own. I think it's going to be a multi-pronged effort where we're going to be trying to donate some, and we're going to be helping others acquire some and produce their own.
Many experts think COVID in one form or another is here to stay as part of the human experience. What will that look like, and how might it affect us after the immediate crisis of the pandemic has receded?
Well, I think in an ideal world, we make coronavirus look in some ways more like the flu or measles, where most of us are vaccinated, most of us are protected through vaccination. You're always going to have some people who refuse to be vaccinated. Maybe the vaccine doesn't take because they have immunosuppression, so their immune system doesn't work properly. We are going to have some level of ongoing transmission. And so it's really important that we also continue to do the work of developing treatment so we have better treatments for those people who do get sick with this in the long term.
Dr. Celine Gounder is an internist, infectious disease specialist, and epidemiologist at the Grossman School of Medicine at NYU and Bellevue Hospital. She was COVID advisor to the Biden transition team. She hosts the podcast Epidemic and American Diagnosis. Dr. Gounder, thank you for spending this time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.